Thursday afternoon. All right, a lot to talk about. We're a little behind, so jump right in. Ian Scher will be here later in the program to talk about the crackdown on Nazi groups online, different social media sites. And also, the Justice Department is asking, remember the protests on Inauguration Day? I think there was a car set on fire. So the Justice Department has gone to a website, and it's demanding the email addresses of everyone at that rally. So we'll talk to Ian about that. We always get things started with Dennis Rodkin, not always, every other Thursday. Writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. Welcome back, friend. How are you?
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Okay, so tax reform is next. Well, the president introduced infrastructure in a way
right.
This week, but they're talking about tax reform as well. And, you know, every time I hear that, I'm like, well, you guys are talking about tax cuts.
Right.
That's what you're doing. You're going to cut rich people's taxes and call it reform. Well, maybe not. Maybe my taxes are going to go up.
Your taxes may change dramatically, yeah.
There's a movement to eliminate the deduction for state and local taxes. Well, what's that? That's not just your income. That's your mortgage,
your property
taxes as well. And that's a big chunk of money.
For Chicagoans, for Illinoisans, it is. That's a big change. All of your property taxes, all taxes you pay to one government, you can deduct when you pay your federal taxes. And because we're a high property tax state, then if that goes away, our deductions change quite a bit.
I would imagine it would impact everyone, though, because if you're not a high property tax state, you might be a higher sales tax or higher income tax, right?
Yeah,
you'd lose
yes.
that as well.
I was looking specifically at the Chicago market
right.
because that's what I do.
But that's a lot of money.
It is. It's about $2.9 billion in deductions that Chicago area people would not be able to take. It doesn't mean that it's $2.9 billion you would lose, because remember, the tax reform is supposed to pull a whole lot of levers, change everything so that the brackets are different and that sort of thing, and in the process get rid of various deductions. And supposedly, if these deductions go away, they will be mitigated, that effect will be mitigated by the other changes in tax reform. However, if you just look at the loss of the state and local tax deduction for Chicagoans, that makes a big difference. It's about a $2,000 change in what you can deduct for most Chicago households, or on the average around Chicago, and it's about $2.9 billion in deductions that we would lose.
So the grand plan would be they take that away, but maybe put you in a lower tax bracket.
Yeah, your tax structure changes.
Okay, I'm going to sit over here and hold my breath while that happens.
Exactly. Yeah, right. It's a very complicated process they've got. If we even get started on federal tax reform, it's pretty complicated. But on the homeownership front, that would be a big effect.
I mean, homeownership is a huge engine when it comes to communities or whatever taxes.
Yeah.
But, you know, also personal wealth. People build their personal wealth in their home. And you've got a story this week about how in the area, we're not doing so good at that.
We are. Yeah. Well, you know, you and I have discussed many times, Chicago's real estate recovery has been slower than most around the country. It did start to accelerate earlier this year, but it really hasn't caught fire. And so there's new data out from Adam, a real estate information company that I crunched down to determine that in Chicago, we are behind. We're the last of the top 20 cities. We're the lowest of the top 20 cities on generating new home equity. We have the largest number of people at the bottom end who are what's called severely underwater.
Right.
That means you owe at least 125% of the value. You owe more than your mortgage. You owe more on your mortgage than your house is worth. And that's a very difficult position to be in. We have the most of those. We also have the least of the people who have a really healthy equity stake. They're called equity rich. Their mortgage is only 50% or less of the value of the house.
And that's 15% of us?
15%
of us
on that side, yeah.
And the national average is 25%.
It's about 25, yeah. So we have fewer people with really big, healthy equity stakes, and we have more people who are in a big, deep hole on equity or on what they owe and at risk of foreclosure. So in general, our household income just isn't being fed and rewatered the way homeowners in other cities are getting it.
68% of the homes in Park Forest are severely underwater.
Yeah.
68%.
Well, let's be real clear. It's 68% of the homes that have a mortgage. So if your home is paid off, it wouldn't be counted.
Okay.
And large numbers of homes have already been foreclosed in Park Forest. So these are 68% of the people who still have
a mortgage. How do you come back from that?
Well, unfortunately, you know, story after story after story, I have people who have said that, not specifically about Park Forest, but when there are these kinds of numbers this far into the problem, you're likely never to come back. This is why you and I talked about a story I did about how hard hit the South Suburbs and the South Side neighborhoods are, where it just feels as if the recovery will never dawn.
Dennis Rodkin is in the studio, writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. And, you know, while I'm reading that PermaSeal commercial, I'm thinking, there are a whole area, you know, for us, flooded basements are such a part of real estate.
Yeah.
There are whole areas of the country where that just would sound silly to them.
Yeah, where they don't even have basements. Where they're built on ground surface. Yeah.
Okay, let's go to the bomb shelter. Now, why in the world did you write a story about homes for sale with bomb shelters?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe because of the threat that is hanging over our heads. Maybe because of the saber rattling between Washington, D.C. and North Korea.
And there is one, or there are a couple homes?
I found one listed, and one is going to list very soon, is coming on the market very soon, unless somebody has rushed in to get it in the time since my story came out. A lot of homes have had bomb shelters, and in many cases they've been converted into something else, or the basement has been completely refinished. But I actually found a home in Homewood where they're pretty sure this little concrete room at the back of the basement was the bomb shelter.
Is this the home that was built in 51?
Yeah.
Well, perfect time.
A time when you would have built such a... And it's only had two owners between 51 and the current... The current seller is only the second owner. And the real estate agent, I called the real estate agent and he and I were laughing about it. And he said, well, as it happens, I also have a home that I'm rehabbing. He doesn't live there. He bought it to rehab in Oak Forest that has a bomb shelter.
And he knows that's a bomb shelter.
Yeah, and he's certain. In the first case, he's pretty certain. In the second, he's certain that these houses have bomb shelters. So it was just, you know, it was kind of a fun story to say. I always try to be topical, Steve.
Right. Well, and I suppose, and like I said, the one for sale, he's pretty sure, not positive.
Right.
But it's kind of a nice thing to throw in there, too, to get people's attention.
And what's interesting,
it's a bomb shelter / wine cellar.
Exactly. He had put it in before all this was happening. It's been on the market about a month and a half, and he had put the language in. But then when I called, he said, yeah, I guess I had a good idea. Maybe I should move it up.
Right. Okay, so there's the bomb shelters. Let's go. I love the story about this mansion in Uptown.
Yeah.
That was a mortuary. It was a Native American kids' home. It was...
A homeless shelter for teens.
And now it's up for sale as a what?
It's just sold.
Oh, it did sell.
Probably to be rehabbed. It's a mansion.
Oh, yeah. It was like in 12 days.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sold fast. It's a mansion designed by George Washington Mayer, who did a lot of the mansions in Uptown and Kenilworth and other places. It's was a beautiful place built in 1895. By 1934, it was a mortuary. And when John Dillinger... died in a shootout at the Biograph Theater with law enforcement authorities. After his body was taken to the police station, it was taken to that mortuary to be embalmed. And you might know there were crowds outside the Biograph after he was shot.
Sure.
There were also crowds that showed up outside the mortuary. His father came to the mortuary to collect the body. And so that's one of the sort of historical things that happened there. More recently, it was a homeless shelter. It's not a homeless shelter, a center for homeless teens, a residential place for homeless teens. And it's in pretty bad shape. It sold for only in the 600,000s. And it looks to me as if it'll cost a few hundred thousand to bring back.
All right. But it was sold. It didn't last long.
It didn't last long. The people who bought it did not return my call. I think they're returning it to residential use, but I don't know that without their confirmation.
Okay. So we're hopscotching all over the place, but I'm torn to what I want to talk to next. Tell me about Yusuf Jackson.
Yeah.
Better known as Jesse Jackson's, one of his children.
Right.
He had the beer distributorship.
The beer distributorship.
Now he's buying homes on the South Side, including a lakefront home.
Yeah.
Who knew there was such a thing?
Well, there, as it happens, I did know because I wrote about the house next door years ago. There's this little cove. It's a fascinating place, South Shore Boulevard, just south of the South Shore Cultural Center. There's this little sort of cove with five houses on it, and they actually have Lake Michigan as their backyard. You can walk out from this house through the backyard and right onto the water.
It's a beachfront home.
Yeah, not uncommon in the suburbs, on the North Shore suburbs, but in the city, as far as I can determine, there are six privately owned houses with beaches, one in Edgewater and these five. And this one was up for sale. It was a foreclosure. It's in terrible shape. It actually has an interesting history. It was built for Charles Stevens, who had the Chaz Stevens department stores.
Yeah.
And it's been in, it was in their family for 98 years. And it's been handed over and handed over a couple of times. And Yusuf Jackson bought it. So I was interested because it had sold and it has this beach. I called the real estate agency. She said, yeah, I think my buyer will probably call you. And I said, oh, okay. And then I pick up the phone and it says, hi, this is Yusuf Jackson. I said, you mean the son of
the one?
And he said, yeah, he's buying properties. And this one he felt was, I mean, it's a piece of South Shore history, both because of that cove and because of Chaz Stevens.
And because he used to play around there.
And yeah, he grew up going to a neighbor's house, one of those houses on that cove.
All right. Check it out, chicagobusiness.com. We're out of time. Dennis Rodkin, thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Steve.
We'll see you in a bit.
Yep.
This Thursday afternoon along Michigan Avenue. Thanks very much for tuning in. Ian Schur is a writer for CNET.com, and he joins us from time to time on Thursdays and is on a phone line with me now. Ian, welcome back to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. You know, there's so much to talk about when it comes to these hate groups. It's interesting to me that the AP has said they will no longer use the phrase alt-right in their reporting because they think that sort of sanitizes the fact that these guys are white nationalists or racists and things such as that. So, and one of the ways that they are able to communicate so well is through social media, through the internet, whether it's Reddit or whatever, right? And so after this happens, you know, we always react after it. It's not as if they didn't exist last Thursday. But Reddit and others are sort of trying to, limit their access, cut down on their sites? Or what exactly are they doing?
They're actually going after the different groups that have been set up. So within Reddit and within Facebook and whatnot, there are groups that are sometimes private or secret that you can set up. I have one that's a secret group for my son that I share photos with family because I don't want it to be available to the wider world. And so these groups are set up for, basically racists to coordinate. And so they obviously, Reddit and Facebook have been aware of these for quite some time, and they've decided to start actually taking them down en masse. And it's a part of a larger tech response, I think. You look at the efforts also by Twitter to start cutting down on conversation there. You know, a lot of these companies have terms of service where they make it explicit that this kind of behavior is not tolerated, and they've been tolerating it for a very long time.
So
now they're enforcing their rules.
You talk about secret groups. So the Daily Stormer is not so secret, right? That was a website that it seems like a soap opera here. It was or was not taken down. They're claiming Anonymous went after it. It seems like maybe they were making that up. Or what's up with the Daily Stormer?
Yeah, so this is one of the world's most popular neo-Nazi websites. And it had, after it wrote a particularly egregious, awful article about the poor woman who died in Charlottesville, basically saying she was a drain on society and terrible things. The people who host that website, which is a public company, GoDaddy, was asked, why are you allowing this site to continue on your service when you have rules in your terms of service that say that you can't allow this kind of speech? And so they told the Daily Stormer they have 24 hours to leave. They switched over to Google. Google then said, no, we're not going to host you either. And so now the Daily Stormer has ended up on the dark web, which is where stuff like you've heard of the drug selling and the child pornography and everything that's shared around. That's what they're sitting next to now instead of being on the legitimate internet where it's a lot easier to find.
So it sounds like they found their peers.
Well, you know, look, I'm not gonna make a moral judgment here, but it certainly makes sense when you think of what how the Daily Stormer traffics and what they typically talk about, that you would find basically hate on the anonymous dark web, because that's where the parts of the internet that a lot of us are not comfortable with have been left to go to.
How about though the whole hacking thing? They said Anonymous hacked into them. Were they just trying to provide cover for the fact that they'd been shut down?
We have no idea, and that's part of the interesting part, right? I mean, there is a long held tradition within the alt-right and within the fringe, hate group, whatever part of the internet, to do fake things and to basically say, someone attacked my website. Oh, this person said this when they didn't. And so it's very possible they're lying. It's really hard to tell. It's part of how the internet works. And even when Anonymous says that they did something, we don't know whether it's true. So it's really hard to tell.
Right, exactly. I mean, Anonymous isn't necessarily the best actor in the world either.
No, they're not. And I mean, that's the other interesting that's fascinating about it is that, you know, we're getting not only is Charlottesville exposed a lot about our culture issues, but it's also exposed a lot about internet culture itself as well. And for example, there was this Twitter account called Yes, You're Racist,
yeah,
which has been around since 2012. And it has tried to expose what it believes to be racist people for their views on the internet, right? So you say something repugnant on Facebook, they would go and find out where you worked and then ask your boss whether or not they're comfortable with you exposing these views publicly. And so they got a number of people fired over the weekend. One guy in Berkeley who worked for a hot dog stand, there was a college student who was in one of the more viral photos that went around of the really angry photos. We have it on CNET, who pleaded with everyone, you know, I'm not the angry racist that they see in this photo, which is interesting when you consider he was with all these people with these tiki torches. And then the other thing, though, is that this mob vigilante justice doesn't always work well. This is part of why it's very uncomfortable and weird. You know, you remember when Reddit had identified the Boston bomber, they thought it turned out they ruined someone's life who it wasn't. And so same thing here. They identified someone who they claimed was at the march who actually wasn't. He was thousands of miles away and didn't agree with it. And so he's still getting hate mail and death threats. Very weird and all of that.
Yeah, I want to talk, though, also about the Inauguration Day protest where people were protesting, in this case, President Trump. I think there was a couple of car fires there. And now the Justice Department, explain this for me, is going after a website that might have promoted it or hosted it, and they want to know emails of people who were at that protest?
They want to actually know the identifiable code of those people. So there's a thing called an IP address, which is basically your address on the internet. So every device you have has one, and whenever you're connected to the internet, it's a way to identify you. And so the Justice Department is actually seeking more than 1 million of these addresses of people who visited the site. So think about this, right? It's not people who went and protested. It's not the people who started the car fires. It's actually just people who went to this website, which includes me, because as a reporter, I was curious about what it was about. And so it's really interesting that this is, you know, one of those questions about whether this is okay. You know, the people who were running this website say that it's a broad overreach and it's going to chill the First Amendment because, you know, you have a right to speak without the government interfering. And so it's going to be really interesting to see, you know, this website DisruptJ20, I think it was, .org, you know, they just did organize the protests from everything I could tell. And so, but now they're being gone after by the government.
And so, tell me, there's DreamHost is the outfit that published the search warrant of Disrupt20.org. Am I reading that correctly? Okay. And
right.
So
DreamHost is the people, so they run the servers that this website was stored on, right? So the people who were the protesters paid DreamHost to have their website on the internet.
And so the government would like to get the identities of people who were in the area or who logged onto this website. And then what? You're going to come under investigation? They're going to investigate all of you guys?
I have no idea. That's part of the reason that this is interesting, right? And I've spoken to a couple of lawyers who tell me that it's pretty common when the government is seeking something like this that it will be very broad request. And what happens is that then there's a hearing, which, by the way, this one in this case will be tomorrow, where the judge and the government and the defenders all kind of debate and squabble and kind of narrow down what they're looking for.
So you can't have that, but maybe you can have this.
Exactly, right? So it's very likely that's what's going to ultimately happen. But, you know, these things happen quite often, but we don't see them as public, which is what I think is truly interesting about this story, is that we're going to see this play out in a very public way, and we're going to get a view into how the Trump administration specifically and the Justice Department wants to treat protesters and how it will be different from other administrations in the past.
That is Ian Schur. He writes for CNET, in fact, executive editor of news at CNET.com. Ian, great to talk to you again. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. John Williams coming up just around the corner. I'm Steve Bertrand. Thanks very much for tuning in. Glad you do. And hope you follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand, on Facebook as well. Okay, so you've heard the name Midwest Laundries. We've been talking about it a lot in recent weeks. MidwestLaundries.com, spelled IES, Com. Jim Schultz is in the studio, the man behind that. How did I do on that? I just almost did a live read for you.
That's not too bad. That's not too bad. Free airtime.
Bring that mic a little bit closer to you.
Sure.
All right. So you're here. Tell me, just give me 30 seconds on what Midwest Laundries does.
So Midwest Laundries is a distributor of commercial and coin laundry equipment. Our clientele ranges all the way from folks with a 2-, 3-, 4 unit building who need small machinery, coin laundromats, hotels, spas, anywhere there's a commercial laundry machine.
They come to you and they can get it.
Right, yeah, parts and service and all everything like that.
All right, so you're here to tell me about a story about how you got ripped off by something called friendly fraud. What happened?
Yeah, we did. Earlier this year in the spring, we were targeted by a ring of thieves, and they had called in, posing as management companies or apartment owners, saying they needed to order machinery.
So I call you. I'm like, hey, Jim, I need a washer and dryer machine.
You need a machine.
Here's
no
my
problem.
Credit card number.
Here's your number. Hey, and by the way, I'm going to send down my guy in his truck or one of my crew members. No problem at all. We'll load him up. So this goes on. They call. We get the machinery ready. Send somebody in. Truck pulls up. They pick up about 20. Total, it was about 24 to 25 machines, I believe.
So you think you're doing pretty well here, some nice sales.
Yeah, things are going well. And this happened over about a four-week period. And turns out, after about 4 weeks after the final sale, we started to get calls from our credit card processor that said, hey, you know what, these charges were fraudulent. And we said, well, why are they, you know, how come nothing came back and nothing was flagged? There seemed to be no issues with any of the charges up front. And then within about 2 weeks, all the money from those charges was taken out of our account. So we were we're out the equipment, and then we were out the money shortly thereafter. So it was a pretty tough lesson to learn.
So people were stealing the credit card, right?
Right.
And then they were calling you pretending to buy a washer and dryer.
Yep.
And then they'd send a guy pick it up. Then they've got this laundry equipment.
Right.
So what are they doing with that?
Who knows? Fencing it somewhere on the secondary market, I'm sure.
Right. I mean, they're not worried about their kids' clothes.
I'm doubting that. You know, I highly doubt that. So right. I'm sure if they could get a few $100 a machine, they're doing it.
And how much are you out on this?
Just over $30,000. So yeah, like I said, it was a tough lesson to learn, but I think it's just something business owners, and we don't deal really with the general public.
Could the police help?
You know, we did go to the police, and they told us they really had a hard time doing anything with this case because they couldn't prove that the people who called us were actually the people who came and picked it up. I mean, we have HD video footage of the folks that came and picked them up. We have the license plate numbers, but they were very hesitant to help, which was slightly frustrating.
Wait, so you had video of the people who picked up fraudulently purchased machinery. You had their license numbers, and the cops didn't go after them?
And they said there was nothing they could do to help us out. And I told them, I said, look, I don't particularly care. I mean, yes, it would be nice if anyone necessarily goes to jail, but how about just investigating and seeing if we could find the product so we're not out the product.
Right.
You know, if we could find it within a few days, maybe we could get it back, resell it.
Are you here to help other people, right?
So yeah, I think other businesses need to be aware that they need to be on the lookout for this. It's not just happening at retail establishments.
How are you? What are you doing to make sure it doesn't happen again? It probably isn't a foolproof method.
No, it's not. But what we've done is now, any time that a client comes to our location, we deliver the vast majority of our machinery. But any time a client decides to come and pick up any machinery, the card holder has to be there in person. They cannot send somebody else. And there also has to be a valid picture ID that we make a copy of now. So we think we're pretty well covered, but businesses should just be aware. And we really weren't that. You need to, as the merchant, you are responsible for the validity of the charge. Yeah. And if it's not valid, you're going to be out the money.
Jim Schultz, the owner of Midwest Laundries. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you,
Thanks for being part of the show. I really appreciate you here.
Absolutely. It was great to be here.